Objections against communism on the basis of religion. As I represent the Islamic point of view, I take up first those aspects of the communist economic system that bear on religion. Number 1. No scope of voluntary efforts. My foremost objection against communism, an objection which all beliefs in life after death must have, is that it leaves little scope for individual voluntary effort, which alone is the basis for earning merit for the life to come. Instead of withholding some reasonable portion of wealth for the state, and leaving the individual free to spend the rest as he wishes, a person is left with nothing more than what suffices for his needs. This deprives him of the means to provide for the life to come. He is given food, he can clothe himself, he is assured of shelter, his education and medical care, but he has not a penny left to provide for the life hereafter. In other words, communism looks after only the material side of a person's life, which may span 40 to 50 years, but entirely ignores the life hereafter that is believed to be everlasting. This is something to which no one who is convinced of the truth of religion and wishes to follow its teachings could ever be reconciled. Islam, for instance, expects, as some other religions do, that its followers spread out and carry its message to the world's four corners so that mankind can seek deliverance. Anyone who remained away from Islam would miss this deliverance, and on the Day of Judgment he would face God as a guilty person. You may call a Muslim mad or a fool for holding such beliefs, but as far as he is concerned and as long as his convictions remain what they are, missionary activity devolves upon him as a duty that he must not shirk in any circumstances. After all, if he wished well for mankind, he would feel obliged to deliver the message that he believes is for its benefit. No one would like his friend to fall in a ditch or be shot to death. How then can one reconcile himself to his friends being given the everlasting punishment and be deprived of paradise and God's nearness and pleasure? Call it what you like. For a person attached to his religion, it is a strong desire to help his brother improve his moral and practical life. There is no room for this sort of work under communism. Any such efforts would be politically curbed. I speak on this point from actual experience of conditions prevailing in Soviet Russia. Some time back, I had sent an Ahmadiyya missionary to this country. But, far from letting him preach his message, the government threw him into prison where he was mercilessly tortured for a long time, and was forced to eat pork. At this point, Hazur Razilahu Anhu pointed to the missionary in question, who was present in the audience, and asked him to rise from his seat so that others could see him. For almost 2 years, this missionary was kept in captivity in various places: Tashkent, Ashgabat, and Moscow. All while in prison, he was subjected to so much torture that he lost his mental balance. Then he was pushed across the border into Iran, from where the British Embassy informed the government of India about him, and the information was sent to me, and at our request, he was repatriated to India at our expense. There are political reasons why the communists disallow religious missionary work, which we need not pursue here. But the issue remains that a minority needs to make tremendous sacrifices to win over the majority to its religion. It certainly involves great personal sacrifice, as well as expense of making available the religious literature, etc. But the communist system leaves no margin for people to spend anything at all on such things. Take the case of the Ahmadiyya movement, for example. We are a very small community, but our aim is to win over the whole world for Islam. In order to convey Islam's message to 170 million Russians, massive expenditure on missionary activity and preparation of literature is required. But we would be unable to fulfill our mission if communists take away all earnings beyond what is needed to meet the barest necessities of life. Communism, besides, opposes religious missionary activity because, from its point of view, this does not constitute useful activity. Only operating a machine, tilling the soil, or working in factories, etc., which yield an economic return, are regarded as productive work. It dismisses religion as consisting of superstitions and foolish fantasies, and as such does not recognize propagation of true faith as useful work. There is, therefore, no reason for the state to permit such parasitic activity. Thus, there is a direct clash between the Islamic conception of life and the communist viewpoint. To a Muslim, it matters little if he has to go hungry so long as he succeeds in improving his chances in the life to come. And he wishes the same for his brethren. If they do not win God's pleasure, their life would have been in vain no matter how much wealth they acquired in this worldly life. Anyone who holds this belief would be duty-bound to help his misguided brethren to provide something for the hereafter. But communism takes away all surplus wealth in the name of protecting the country, thus leaving everyone to suffer a spiritual death. As noted earlier, Islam shares with the communist order the principle of ensuring that everyone gets adequate food, clothing, and shelter, and has access to education and medical relief. The government must, therefore, have sufficient public revenues to discharge these responsibilities. However, apart from taking away surplus funds, communism forbids propagation of our faith. In short, we give them our support, and we do so because this is the teaching of the religion we follow. But communism, instead of being thankful to this religion, repays the kindness by depriving it of all opportunities for growth on the pretext that it amounts to useless activity and a burden on the national economy. Had communism openly and honestly clashed with religion, we would have differed with it, but we could have had little basis for complaint. But the communists profess to be unconcerned with religion, while, by indirect and underhand means, they try to minimize its influence and stifle its spread. They seek to enter our hearts and homes as trusted friends, but betray this trust by covertly destroying the objects that we treasure most. The reality becomes apparent only when it's too late. If communism declared openly that it did not recognize a life in the hereafter, it attached no value to this idea, and it would not permit individuals to preach their religion, whoever accepted communism would do so with eyes open. But outside Russia, these vital aspects of the system are deliberately kept out of sight, behind a fraudulent claim that communism is only an economic philosophy that has no concern with religion and does not clash with it. Missionary activity comprises a fundamental and most vital part of religion, which could not be sustained when the public is denied the right to raise funds for maintaining it, and religion itself cannot long survive. In short, communism aims to strangle the propagation of religion and seeks to establish an irreligious social order. Now consider another aspect of this question. Suppose a Muslim said that he wanted nothing from the Soviet state but be allowed to dedicate his life to the service of religion and to visit every Russian town and village to convey Islam's message. Would the Soviet state permit him to do so? Would his activities not be stopped by straightaway throwing him in prison? There can be only one answer to this question. The communist government of Russia would not hesitate to use force against such a person. He could be locked up in jail and told either to undertake some useful work for his living or go without food or clothing. In other words, if I dedicated my life to God and the study of the Holy Quran and Hadith, a study indispensable for me if I desire to improve my life in the hereafter, communism would view this as a sheer waste of time and an excuse to live at others' expense. A Muslim must refuse to be tied down to the ultra-materialistic theories of communism in matters of such transcending spiritual importance. He must insist on his right to be guided by the Holy Quran, which deems it necessary that among the Muslims there should always exist a body of men entirely devoted to the task of calling people to the right path and dissuading them from the wrong. Allah the Almighty says, وَلْتَكُمْ مِنْكُمْ أُمَّةٌ يَدُعُونَ عَلَى الْخَيْرِ وَيَأْمُرُونَ بِالْمَعْرُوفِ وَيَنْهَوْنَ عَنِ الْمُنْكَرِ. That is, O Muslims, there must always be among you a group of people who free themselves from the materialistic pursuits to oversee the religious obligations. The duties assigned to such people would be that they will enjoy piety, motivate people to carry out good deeds, and forbid them from immorality. In other words, Islam requires that a group of Muslims must be totally dedicated for this task. It is true that Islam accords no special privileges to such devotees, but they are assigned certain specific duties that they must carry out. While there is no priesthood in Islam, it does call for a religious order to spread its message. Christianity gives to the priest some additional privileges, but in Islam, even those who serve religion have the same rights as everyone else, though their work is well defined and is of a religious nature, to spread Islam and to plant it deep in the hearts of people so that they can live up to it and to regard this duty as their highest purpose in life. Deprived of the spiritual nucleus of such a body of men, the Islamic order could not survive, for it requires people who understand its rules and regulations and who are willing to spread its ideals. Among the world's religions, Islam is the most detailed, encompassing a comprehensive and complete law. It has a clear teaching on the devotion and worship due to God, a clear teaching in regard to the economic aspect of man's life, his political activities, moral and ethical questions, social relationships dealing with employment, education, family life and business dealings, law of inheritance, international affairs, judiciary precepts and procedures, and a host of regulations designed to cover every conceivable contingency in human life. Each of these aspects demands a thorough study, which is impossible unless a body of capable men make it the object of their lives. If such persons were stamped out of existence, from whom would the ordinary person learn? What would they learn? And how would Islam spread in the world? Tafsir, commentary of the Holy Quran, is a vast branch of learning in itself that cannot exist independently of competent scholars devoted to its study, involving a thorough grasp of its earlier works and traditions, a command over the language, its usage and grammar, familiarity with the hadith, sayings of the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, and a study of comparative religions, Arab and Jewish history, and the Bible. All this cannot be achieved without a lifelong effort, though of course a person might be blessed with his knowledge directly from the divine source. But this is very rare, perhaps once in a century. Others can acquire it only through diligent study based upon righteousness. In the communist state, such work is not considered work at all. It would not permit anyone to spend 12 years in studying and then a lifetime of teaching it to others. Such a person would be imprisoned or deprived of food and lodging, as he is a useless burden on the state. The situation is similar with respect to the branch of learning known as hadith. It involves careful study of dozens of works and their expositions, Arabic usage and grammar, and careful scrutiny of the chain of narrators in the case of each hadith. Without a proper study of hadith, a lifelong activity, adequate knowledge of the details of Islamic teaching is impossible. Similarly, in the case of the branches of learning known as fiqh, religious knowledge, qaza, jurisprudence, history, the sawwuf, meaning mysticism, and teachings of Islam in social and economic activities. All of these are branches of study that cannot be ignored without turning Islam into a dead letter, and no Muslim worth the name could ever be reconciled to such a state of affairs. But there is no place for such scholars or their students under communism. The state would consider them unproductive and grant them no allowances. People themselves would have no means for supporting them through voluntary private donations, as is the experience in countries like India, China, and Arabia. The truth is that between Islam and the other religions on one side, and communism on the other, there is a fundamental difference in the conception of what constitutes work. Our view is that a machine operator, a person propagating or teaching religion, and a recipient of religious education are all engaged in useful work. Communism, however, accords this status only to a machine operator, while those teaching or learning religion are regarded as parasites. To teach the alphabet is useful work according to the communist view, but to teach the profound truth, La ilaha illallah Muhammadur Rasulullah, there's none worthy of worship but Allah and Muhammad is his messenger, is a waste of time and energy. Thus, while we are in accord with communism that only useful workers may have their labor rewarded, we cannot accept at all that no work is to be considered useful unless the communists so certify. In the estimation of communists, to work for the betterment of one's spiritual life is no work at all. To teach or learn the Holy Quran, hadith, fiqh, tafsir, tasawwuf, and to teach morality is no work. In the eyes of a Muslim, on the other hand, these things are far more precious than life itself. To ensure the proper study of religion and that adequate effort is made for its propagation, thousands of scholars are needed in a country like Soviet Russia with its Muslim population of 30 million. But communist Russia would only look upon them as shirkers, idlers, and worthless people, who are a burden on society and need to be quickly eliminated. These two views stand poles apart. It is impossible to reconcile them. Undoubtedly, some do claim to serve religion, but they are imposters who do not practice what they claim. But a person who really and truly serves religion at the cost of personal comfort and gain deserves to be recognized as a true leader. He holds a position similar to that of the soul in relation to the body. He is our greatest benefactor. To the communist, however, such persons are only despicable scamps or idlers and traitors to the nation, who should be imprisoned or driven out of the country. There is someone who, in our estimation, stands so high that the mightiest rulers of this earth carry less weight and value in our eyes than the dust on his feet. It is the deepest and fondest desire of our hearts to sacrifice our lives for him. He is Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, the greatest benefactor of mankind, who illuminated the human soul with divine light. But, according to the communist way of thinking, he would be considered, God forbid, as a burden upon his people, as were all the chosen ones of God before him, Jesus, Moses, Abraham, Krishna, Ramchandra, Buddha, Zoroaster, Guru Nanak, and Confucius, peace be upon them all. The Soviet regime would, God forbid, send all such persons into workshops to make shoes or clothing for farm and factory workers, or assign them with the task of cutting other people's hair. Failing that, they would be deprived of food, since according to them they are parasites and a burden on the national economy. Communism does, however, recognize the work of painters and sculptors as creative artists, but considers work done to uplift people's souls or morals as utterly useless. As we all know, man does not live by bread alone, and food by itself cannot give him peace of mind. The world is full of people who, if prevented from praying to God, would have no peace, no matter what luxuries of life were placed at their disposal. It is indeed odd that communism recognizes it as work when laborers spend a few hours in factories, but then go out to dissipate themselves in drink, cinema, or dance halls. Photography and music, too, are considered useful pursuits, but moral improvement and purification of the soul constitute no work at all. Some time ago, Marshal Malinovsky was asked about his son's interests. He responded, laughing, "They are interested in photography, music, and keeping rabbits." A child of 15, in other words, who spent his time in photography and music or in scampering after pet rabbits, deserves to be fed and taken care of by communism. But the Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, Jesus Christ, Moses, Krishna, Buddha, Zoroaster, and Guru Nanak, peace be upon them all, are, God forbid, considered as parasites and dangers to society. They are not worthy of being called workers. History provides no example that matches the selfless, ceaseless labor of love undertaken by these great moral benefactors of mankind. But for their toil and effort, humanity would have lacked social cohesion, which depends on the sense of moral obligations that developed only after colossal sacrifices on the part of these great teachers, who worked and suffered for the human cause day and night. Yet communism condemns them as worthless people and places them far lower in the scale than drunkards and debauchers who work in factories for hardly 8 hours a day, then give themselves up to all sorts of low and vulgar pursuits. In short, there's no place for these great and noble souls in the communist system. I cannot speak for others, but I do know that in a state that provides no place for the Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, there can be none for me. We can regard as ours only that country or regime that accords to the Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam a place of ultimate honor. A country close to him must be a country close to every true Muslim. Communism must cover up this stark reality from religious believers to win their sympathy and allegiance, but it can never attract them if the truth is told. Communists are prone to assert that they do not oppose any religion. The communists might declare that they do not oppose religion, but in reality that is not the case. Their oral pronouncements are therefore no more than lies. Regarding this point, it may be mentioned that Russia obstructs religious education on grounds that parents have no right to impart religious knowledge to their children and thereby influence their leanings. Communists argue that it would be cruel to allow parents to influence their children, as they lack judgment to freely decide for themselves. Children must be allowed to choose for themselves about religion upon reaching adulthood. On the surface, it seems to be a fair and reasonable demand, but in reality, it is cruel and terrifying. All religions seek to propagate a positive message, the existence of God, whereas non-believers deny it. Those with a positive message have the responsibility to spread it. Non-believers need to do nothing. Thus, the communist position is not one of equality, but is deceptive and unjust. It can be likened to a situation where a man is barred from telling his child about his being the father, but is then given assurance that no one else would be allowed to deny his fatherhood. If a child is not taught the alphabet or history, he is bound to remain ignorant. Similarly, for religious education. As stated earlier, religious has a positive message to impart, but non-believers are just deniers. By not allowing religious education, the deniers are the ones who achieve their goal. Thus, while communism claims to be impartial on religion, it is only committing treachery. This is not impartiality or equality in treatment, but fraud and deception. The Holy Quran plainly proclaims, "Teach man what he did not know." As soon as you have ruled out the possibility of teaching, you put those so deprived at a disadvantage and place them in a position of pre-Islamic days of ignorance and prevent Muslims from carrying out their duty. There are some other points that arise in this connection, but as I am not addressing aspects of communism that are not related to economics, I shall not go into them here. Apart from the harm flowing from its opposition to religion, communism is defective when judged on the basis of reason and common sense as well. It is not in human power to establish complete equality for all, covering all aspects of life. Happiness does not depend on money alone, nor do contentment, solace, and the peace of mind spring only from the satisfaction of material wants. Besides, given the same standards of living, the amount of pleasure derived must differ greatly from individual to individual. Given the same quality of meal, some people will eat it with greater relish than others at the same table. The sense of taste, smell, eyesight, or general health varies among people. Intellectual and physical capabilities are a great source of self-confidence and consequent happiness, but no state action can make these factors equal for everyone. Our near and dear ones are a great source of happiness, but no regime can guarantee that wives, children, parents, or friends of each individual would live equally as long. The presence of children around the hearth satisfy the deepest needs of human nature, but no one can guarantee that all married couples will have children, or have an equal number of children, or that the children will all live equally long, be equally healthy, or achieve equal success in life. The pangs of separation from a loved one can be a source of great pain. A mother who has lost her only child will not relish a sumptuous meal, whereas a poor mother who holds her child in her lap will enjoy even a simple meal more than a feast. The intensity of emotions in regard to dear ones may be judged from the following incident in Lenin's life. The Russian Communist Party split into two groups at an early stage of its history because of some fundamental differences in viewpoints. The Mensheviks, who were led by Martov, held the view that on gaining political power, the communist system must abolish capital punishment. But Lenin, who led the Bolsheviks, while accepting the principle, wanted to delay its adoption until after the Tsar had been executed. The basic reason for Lenin's tougher stance was that the Tsarist government had previously ordered his brother, to whom he was deeply attached, to be hanged in connection with a crime, and Lenin wanted to have his revenge on the Tsar. The suffering of our friends and relatives thus profoundly affects our happiness, and no one can take out an insurance against such suffering. It is therefore beyond the power of man to remove or level up inequalities in countless aspects of human life. And the kind of equality that communism rants about is little more than a delusion. Abiding happiness comes from the relationship with God alone, because all contingencies are under His control. You may grant food and clothing in equal amounts, but the man who lacks the relationship with God can have no peace. There are countless things whose presence or absence cause dissatisfaction, but it is entirely up to God to grant or withhold them. Number 2. Communism interferes with property rights. Russia, under the Tsars, was not an industrial country. It consisted of large country estates owned by hereditary nobles. Land, therefore, was the first concern of communism in Russia, not industry. Whatever Karl Marx wrote about capitalism concerned mainly big money and industry, as he was born and educated in Germany, which was far more industrialized. When Lenin and other Russian revolutionary leaders adopted his philosophy and tried to apply his theories to Russian conditions, they came up with the following principles. Number 1. All land belongs to the state. Number 2. Land must therefore be taken over by the state and be redistributed to those willing to till the soil. Number 3. Each landowner should have just enough land that could be cultivated by him alone and no more. Number 4. Land as property of the state must be utilized to its full potential. The cultivator as agent of the state must accept the decisions of the state regarding use of land. Right to own land. Islamic teachings, the broad principles of which have already been explained, is that all land belongs to God, who recognizes just titles to portions of it, subject to the condition that at the death of the title holder, the land should be divided among stipulated heirs in specified portions, one share for each boy, one half share for the girl, and one third share for the parents, and that in no case must it be passed on to any single heir by excluding the others. In the absence of children, the land would be divided among brothers, sisters, and parents, and if there were no legitimate heir, the land would revert to God's representative, which is the state in this case. No one may bequeath more than one-third of his inheritance, with the condition that none of the stipulated heirs must have any share in this one-third. This teaching is full of wisdom, because, number 1, the right of ownership is recognized, therefore every owner would be inclined to put their land to best use, as his livelihood depends on it. Number 2, because the owner's children know that one day they too would be cultivating the land, they would strive to gain expertise in farming. Number 3, even where there are large land holdings, initially they would be subdivided into smaller lots over time because of the law of inheritance. Number 4. Finally, because Islam maintains that all land belongs ultimately to God, no one may acquire it through illegitimate means. Under non-Islamic systems, conquered territories are given away to the companions of the conqueror or to those with influence. It is because of this system that the Norman conquerors were able to parcel out land in certain areas of England, Scotland, and Ireland to chosen nobles, while leaving the inhabitants landless, with no place to even build their own homes. This situation persists in several areas to this day, where large owners rent out their buildings, but retain their power and influence. The same thing happened in France, Germany, Austria, and Italy, though some improvement in the situation occurred following the Napoleonic Wars. In the United States of America, too, as the country developed, a group of big landowners emerged through the simple expediency of dispossessing as many of the original inhabitants as they could manage, and then continued to hold on to what they had gained, or rather usurped. And the same story repeated itself in Austria and Kenya, where English settlers took possession of hundreds of thousands of acres, leaving the natives landless. As a result of the Islamic conquest in Arabia, the conquerors were given a portion of the land. Since in Arabia proper, arable land was limited, there was little danger of large illicit landowners to emerge. In Yemen and Syria, however, both of which had a long-established agricultural tradition, land was left in the possession of the original owners. Iraq, in contrast, was a sparsely populated but fertile country that had been evacuated when the Persians moved back to their own country. Although some generals in the victorious Islamic army did initially try to redistribute the land among the conquerors, Hazrat Umar r.a. disapproved of the idea. His reason was that he could foresee the harm it could do to succeeding generations. He therefore retained the vanquished land as government property. Similarly, in Egypt, original landowners were left in possession of the land. In short, in the shape given to the Islamic order at the outset, it was recognized that vacant lands that came under Muslim authority in conquered territories were to remain in the state's hands and be used in the general interest of all, instead of being distributed among the top leadership. This was done to avoid the emergence of a landed aristocracy, as happened in Europe. During later periods, it is true, the Islamic teaching was not fully observed, but Muslim rulers were never altogether freed from its influence. In India, too, when the Muslim rule came to the country, the land was left with the old owners whose tenure was preserved. Only vacant land was taken over by the state. All of the large estates found in India today were created later under the British rule. The new rulers were eager to settle matters and gain influence in the country, regardless of whether this was achieved through favor or fear. In most cases, the new governments in Bengal and Uttar Pradesh bestowed title to the tehsildars, the tax-collecting agents, over areas found in their jurisdiction. This was a terrible injustice to the real owners of those lands. Thus, the Islamic system applies to land ownership in a manner similar to its application in other economic spheres, meaning there is no place for large landowners and the government cannot create a class of large landowners by redistributing state land. It is another matter that a person might purchase additional land, but there is not much scope for this either. If it is a trader, he is unlikely to purchase land as he might make more money in trade. If he is already a landowner, his means to purchase additional land are in any case limited and not significant enough to harm the country's economic condition. Furthermore, thanks to the laws of inheritance, the size of land ownership would decline within one or two generations. Islamic approach to reduce land holdings as compared with communist approach. It should also be borne in mind that Islam does not allow anyone, not even someone who has no heirs and has made a will, to dispose of more than one-third of his property according to his own wishes. If he does have heirs, the land would be distributed in successive generations. If someone wishes to bequeath one-third to an heir for family prestige, Islam would not permit it, because none of the heirs are permitted to take any part of this one-third. Consequently, large land holdings under the Islamic system are virtually impossible. Even someone without an heir cannot bequeath more than one-third to anyone. The remainder will revert to the state, and thus be of benefit to the public at large. Another strength of this system is that while it prevents a landed aristocracy from interfering with the uplift of the poor, it does not curtail individual freedom. In fact, it leaves everyone free to develop intellectually, promote his family life, and allows him to do whatever is necessary for the preparation for the life to come. In contrast, the measures adopted by communism to translate its ideology into practice destroy individual liberty, kill domestic harmony, and deny any chance of serving one's religion. What is more, communism has utterly failed to implement what it originally sought. In regard to land, communism held that all land belonged to the state, an approach that made the state the sole landowner while transforming the farmers into mere wage earners. Communism thereby placed landowners at a disadvantage compared to merchants and industrialists, who, to a certain extent, were given property rights over what they possessed. Because the state was the sole owner of the land, communism held that state was entitled to direct the farmer what to sow and where to sow it. Moreover, as some farmers had more experience in handling certain crops, the state was entitled to send them wherever their expertise was needed. When these ideas were implemented countrywide, farmers came to realize that, number one, the status had been reduced to that of mere laborers, lower than that of merchants or artisans. Number two, their family life had been deprived of all stability, and the right of their descendants to enjoy the fruits of their labor had been usurped. Number three, they were liable to be moved from their farms and sent off to unknown places at any time. Number four, they were no longer able to choose their crops in order to stay self-sufficient. Instead, they were made to cultivate in accordance with the state's dictates. This destroyed the previous system under which villages and towns were self-sufficient. Because of these developments, the landowners rebelled and maintained their resistance for a number of years, resulting in a fall in agricultural output. Finally, Stalin abrogated that system and re-established the old system that provided for the right of private ownership over land, along with some latitude in cultivating what the landowners desired. Although the rebellion subsided, this decision on the part of the Bolshevik leader demonstrated once and for all that the communist system was seriously flawed. Consequently, Stalin's enemies accused him of betraying the communist principles as laid down by Lenin. Stalin's response to this accusation was that the key goal of communism was the establishment of a proletarian regime. No harm was done if lesser principles were sacrificed in the attainment of the ultimate goal. In any case, this instance showed that as a permanent system of political economy, communism failed to translate its policies regarding land ownership into action, and that in tackling this question, the communists had to borrow ideas from other systems. This glaring failure of the communist system demonstrates that the inherent superiority of the Islamic economic system, and shows that communism is not a principled philosophy, rather just a political movement seeking to strengthen Russia. To assert itself as an alternative to religion is a violation of truth and rectitude. Stephen King Hall, a member of the British Parliament, recently visited Russia and published an article in the Soviet Union News, in which he stated that Russia currently had two goals. First, the reconstruction of Russia, and second, to make it the best and richest country in the world. Communism is, therefore, basically a political movement with the primary objective of making Russia powerful. Number 3. Communism stifles growth of knowledge. Although all are assured of food and clothing in the Soviet regime, its adopted measures also give rise to another grave fault in the system, meaning intellectual progress will gradually die out. Because workers' wages and salaries in this system are barely adequate to pay for food, shelter, and clothing, leaving very little for foreign travel. This is a critical component of education that contributes to the development of scientific and technical knowledge and to the progress of civilization. The Holy Quran has laid great emphasis upon sayr fil ard, that is, traveling in various parts of the earth. When the Russian people had economic freedom, they saved a part of their income for travel to different countries. What they learned from foreign travels helped to enrich their country and contributed to national progress. This is the path nature has established for promoting progress, and many nations have benefited by adopting it. The Holy Quran has also enjoined travel to different lands, for without it, one's perspective remains constricted. But because of the communist system, it is now impossible for Russians to freely travel abroad, and the same thing will happen wherever communism spreads. Its inevitable consequence would be an intellectual decline. Since the revolution, one does occasionally come across a communist government representative, but it is extremely rare to meet an ordinary citizen from a communist country. As the imam of a large and far-flung religious community, I have a wide network of contacts. I have not had the opportunity of meeting an independent Russian communist, though one does occasionally encounter representatives of the Soviet government. This is the consequence of the Soviet policy of not leaving any money in the hands of ordinary citizens beyond what they require to meet the expense of food, clothing, and shelter. It is sometimes said that the country can have access to foreign ideas and inventions through visits of government officials, but this is in fact not so. For one thing, a government official is confined to pursuing only matters related to the purpose of his travel. Secondly, a person traveling on his own volition, interest, and freely interacting with other people is quite different from someone traveling on official duty. Finally, people-to-people interaction can be a source of intellectual growth and instrumental in promoting peace and understanding. The Soviet system precludes that possibility altogether. Ordinary Russians that one comes across outside of Russia are usually emigrants who left their country during the revolution, or are Russian agents engaged in propaganda for the Soviet state. The latter might claim to be independent citizens, unconnected to the government, but it is only a ruse to make the propaganda more effective. It only takes a little common sense to see that ordinary Russians cannot afford luxuries, such as foreign travel, because the state does not leave any spare money in their possession. Some time back, during my travel from Karachi to Lahore, a friend informed me that a Russian who was traveling in the air-conditioned apartment on the same train was claiming to be a private tourist, but was speaking strongly in favor of communism. I asked my friend to tell this gentleman that his claim was utterly false. In the Russian's eyes, I would be considered as a big landowner, but I could afford to only travel in second class. As there were no landowners left in Russia, the traveler must either be a farmer or an ordinary laborer, which would suggest that he was most certainly not a rich man himself. In that case, how would he explain his travel in such luxury? If a Russian worker or farmer could travel in an air-conditioned railway coach, how could he protest against landowners who could barely afford to travel in second class? All the pious wrath of Russian communists against Indian landowners or capitalists was therefore just hypocrisy. Number 4. Force needed to uphold communism. The fourth flaw of communism is that whenever the system encounters a serious difficulty or challenge, it gets replaced by dictatorship, with consequences far worse than before. The reason is that by destroying independent thinking, the system is bereft of new ideas that might help to overcome the challenge. As such, when the process of decline sets in or the system collapses altogether, there would be nothing, other than dictatorship, to fill the vacuum so created. Germany accepted Hitler, mainly because of the communist movements that had swept the country. The experience of the French Revolution also supports that viewpoint. As the first wave of popular fervor over the newfound freedom receded, it gave rise to the autocrat like Napoleon. No one from among the ordinary people could assume the control of affairs under a democratic system. Communism may choose to call itself a proletarian or a totalitarian regime. There is little doubt that this kind of system eventually and inevitably leads to dictatorship. In fact, the current situation is that, although they claim to support representative government, in reality they do not share governance with ordinary citizens. There has only been dictatorship since the inception of communism in Russia. Lenin was the first dictator, who was succeeded by Stalin. Molotov may well be the third dictator, and so on. In any case, such regimes cannot survive without the use of force, and the Russian experiment stands testimony to that. Number 5. Interest, a part of communist philosophy. The fifth flaw of communism is that it has not rejected the institution of interest as part of its philosophy. It is claimed that there are no private banks in Soviet Russia that operate on the basis of interest. I do not at the moment have any certain knowledge that this is actually the case, but the absence of banks that run on the basis of interest is an entirely different matter from rejecting interest as something fundamentally wrong. The absence of such banks may be due to a number of reasons: lack of facilities, general ignorance on the part of the public in regard to the working of banks, or just expediency. When the necessary facilities are installed, the public gets educated about the banking system, or when the opportunistic policy is abandoned, individual banks may start operating throughout the country. But when something is forbidden as a matter of principle, no change in circumstances can make it lawful or acceptable. Communism does not put interest under this absolute ban. There is no prohibition of interest in the communist literature, which leads me to conclude that communism is not fundamentally opposed to the institution of interest. I find, besides, that the Soviet government borrows from other governments that lend only on interest. Thus, it is clear, Communism is not against interest. Indeed, it accepts its use. During this war, the Russian government borrowed from Russian people, which I surmise must have been on interest. If I am correct that communism is not fundamentally opposed to interest, in fact, various developments leave no other conclusion possible, it must be conceded that the dearth of interest-based transactions in the country is only a temporary phenomenon and a consequence of the extraordinary changes that occurred since the overthrow of the old order. With the expansion of Russian trade and industrial development, the Soviet state too would increasingly resort to interest-bearing loans, just as in other European countries. Accordingly, for the successful prosecution of wars and industrial development, the branches of the state bank will be established in the country, and the institution of interest would take the country from communism to capitalism, just as it did in the other Western countries. Number 6. Adoption of prevailing exchange rate system. The sixth flaw of the communist economic system, one that will not let it supersede capitalism, lies in its adoption of the exchange rate mechanism, which emerged out of banks' manipulation and government interference. Communism not only supports this mechanism, but has chosen to act according to its dictates. As it is, the exchange rate, which is the relative price of two currencies, is no longer determined by a country's balance of trade, but is fixed by the great economic powers. In fixing the exchange rate, these powers pursue basically their own self-interest and trade strategy. They take into account not only the current balance of trade, but also the development of future commercial relations. As far as the weaker or poorer economies are concerned, their exchange rates are in the hands of banks. Weaker countries often complain about the prevailing system, but their protests go unheeded, as they continue to face a disadvantage in trade, as they lack sufficient economic influence. As things stand, an exchange rate between two currencies is essentially artificial and can be utilized to their advantage by banks as well as governments. As a result, international trade, instead of being governed by supply and demand conditions in the markets of commodities and precious metals, is driven by the exchange rates between different currencies. Consequently, the trade of the weaker economies is subject to maneuvering on the parts of banks, while the trade of the stronger economies is influenced by political considerations. There is no doubt that the exchange rate system has facilitated commerce, and the growing volume of international trade would not be possible without a satisfactory system of exchange. But it is not necessary that for the exchange rates to be subject to politics and used as a means to exploit poor economies. With careful consideration, it should be possible to adapt the old barter system, which is based on the exchange of goods, not the exchange rate, to meet the present-day requirements of trade, while protecting it from government interference. After due consultation with traders and government representatives, the exchange rate regime could be adjusted as needed, but its guiding principle must remain the exchange of goods rather than paper money. After the war of 1914-18, Germany manipulated its exchange rate and depreciated its currency so much that capital began to flow into the country from all around the world. And when it had built up large enough foreign exchange reserves to meet its commercial requirements, Germany just abolished its currency at little or no cost. This kind of measure could not have been possible under the barter system. Russia did attempt to follow in Germany's footsteps, but because of its lack of financial expertise and backward industry, it could not derive much benefit from it. An artificial exchange rate, in short, is a weapon that the strong can use to gain control over the trade of weaker countries and to make trade flow not in its natural directions, but into channels of their choice. By accepting the prevailing exchange rate system, communist Russia, in effect, has left the foundation of capitalism intact. As a consequence, with the growth of its industries, the country would resort increasingly to this weapon to secure new markets, thereby gaining control over the trade of weaker countries. The Soviet state may, of course, amass great wealth this way, but in the process they would undermine the weaker economies and thus nullify the very principle that gave it birth. Publisher's note. The author's above remarks were both profound and precinct. Soon after the time of this lecture, the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank were established, and currency manipulation by any country was made unacceptable and subject to sanctions. End note. Number 7. Compulsion and economic matters. The seventh flaw is that the communist system requires the use of force to run the economy, which ends up only hurting the country. It seeks to confiscate the wealth of the rich, leaving them with only the bare necessities of life. Irrespective of the merits or demerits of the objective, The issue is that communism regards it legitimate to use force to pursue its objectives. Instead of relying on education and persuasion to make people gradually change their attitudes and become more compassionate towards the poor and accept the principle of equity, communism, on coming to power, employed only force to deprive the rich of their wealth. Clearly, this process could not but rouse hatred for the system on the part of the dispossessed. Those who suffered in the process could hardly have any sympathy instead of resentment for the communist system. Without question, Islam too took away wealth from the rich, but it did not use force. It relied in the first place on persuasion, but it also went on to remove the incentives to amass wealth. This was followed by disencouragement of excessive consumption as well as admonition to give zakat and charity to help the poor. Finally, wealth that still remained at the time of a person's death was distributed among heirs. Thus, while both communism and Islam sought equity, the former relied on forcefully taking away wealth from the rich, while Islam relied on persuasion. The result is that there is a significant cross-section of rich Russians living in other countries that oppose communism for usurping their wealth and reducing some of them to a life of penury. Communists are mistaken in thinking that there is no opposition to the communist system in other countries. They do not realize that the opposition is hushed only because the Western powers, England and America, need Russia's help in the war effort and are not prepared to allow criticism of Russia. As the war comes to an end, the Western governments will not be able to control the freedom of expression, and schemes for the elimination of the communist system will once again begin to emerge. It may be noted that soon after the speech, the Second World War ended and criticisms of communism became very strong, especially in the United States. Number 8. Communism destroys family relations. The eighth flaw in communism is that it destroys home life and family relations, which will ultimately cause its decline. Communism virtually ignores the deep natural bonds between parents and their children, between brothers and sisters, and other close relations united by ties of blood. In its eagerness to indoctrinate them into communism and to move them away from religion, it decided to treat children as belonging to the state. Instead of being raised in the care of the mother and father, the child is put completely under the government's control, at least according to the law. The result is that the family relations are totally disrupted. This state of affairs, too, cannot continue for long. It must change, for otherwise a Russian would cease to be a normal human being. Although communism appears at the moment to be firmly established in Russia, the fact is that communism's evident success is basically due to a reaction against the miseries wrought by the Tsarist regime. If communism continues to be successful after the memory of those sufferings fades away, one could say that it succeeded in eliminating the natural bonds of love between parents and children and among the siblings. Let the world beware that such bonds of love cannot be crushed. A day will dawn when a mother will be loved as a mother, a father will be honored as a father, and a sister will get her due place. The hitherto suppressed bonds will surely reassert themselves. But right now, the system regards a man simply as a machine, not as a man. It has no respect for the feelings of a mother, a father, a sister, or any other relative. This concept of man as a piece of machinery could not survive for long. A time would come when this system would be overthrown and replaced by one that accords due recognition to filial bonds. Number 9. Communism undervalues intellectual excellence. The ninth flaw of communism is that it does not adequately recognize intellectual and mental capabilities, which causes Russians with those capabilities to emigrate to other countries in search of higher awards. Bolshevism regards only manual labor as real work and dismisses intellectual endeavor as wastes of time. Manual labor is undoubtedly important, but it is equally true that intellectual effort has importance of its own, because it is an inherent human trait that people expect to be adequately rewarded for their services. Russia must modify its philosophy if it desires to avail itself of the services of its intellectual giants and scientists. Otherwise, they will slip out to other countries and seek recognition and reward denied to them in their own country. The discoveries and inventions of Russian scientists and engineers will be registered, patented, and exploited not in Russia, but in America. At present, the Soviet government prevents its people from emigration through rigid control. But as Russia's contact with the outside world expands, these controls would have to be relaxed in the interest of foreign trade, if for nothing else. Those who might wish to escape would then have ample opportunity to do so. When Germany began to mistreat Jews, many escaped to America, which benefited from their knowledge and skills. Some of the chemicals, previously manufactured only in Germany, are now being produced in the USA. If Russia were to open its doors to outside contacts, dissatisfied scientists will have a chance to slip out. But if Russia remains closed, its culture will, for want of fresh intellectual stimulus, begin to wither and end up as a pool of stagnant water. Number 10. Rigid control over economy. The 10th flaw of system lies in the rigid control of the Russian economy. The provision of food and clothing is at present government responsibility, and so are industry and foreign trade. Because Russia was industrially backward, it is not possible to assess the country's real economic progress. Nevertheless, one thing is quite clear even now. As long as the products of Russian industry remain shielded from foreign competition and barely meet domestic requirements, it would not be known whether the factories make profits or run at a loss. What would happen to those industries when the home market gets saturated? Would production be reduced thereafter, or would the expansion continue? If a limit on production were imposed, industry would sooner or later start to feel the crippling effect. Continued expansion, on the other hand, would require foreign markets that could absorb the surplus at prices still profitable for Russian manufacturers. When that stage is reached, Russian industry would have to withstand the full force of foreign competition, and its success or failure would depend on how it performs. In any case, Russia from that point onward would end up behaving like any other imperialist country, bent on securing and controlling foreign markets, thereby belaying its claim of freedom of choice. To reiterate, there is at present little incentive to produce at the lowest cost because of the absence of international competition, and this could continue for some time. This situation is similar to the one where a woman grinds 5 kilos of grain manually, which makes her household happy at the amount of work she puts in. But it is only when she goes out to work that she comes to realize the true worth of her work, because she earns considerably more money. Similarly, so long as the Russians consume all that is produced within the country, they would not know whether the economy was progressing or declining. The country appears to be making economic progress right now, but the reality would dawn only when its industry reaches the limits of its expansion. If it manages to survive that dire situation, there would follow another consequence that I describe below. Number 11. Focus on national interests instead of universal welfare. The fact that the communist system is concerned only with national interests, not universal interests, is another major weakness of the system. If Russia somehow succeeds in industrial development, it would be forced to implement a capitalist system that is stronger and even more dangerous for the world than the one it replaces. In the face of this great danger, I'm at a loss to understand why a segment of our intelligentsia is so strongly in support of communism. The fact is that Russia has presented collectivist ownership in a manner that others are easily impressed, but a time will come that its damage to the world will become obvious. People are impressed that communism has ensured provision of food and clothing for everyone, and that is something we too welcome, but the greatest danger that lurks in its shadow must not be disregarded. That danger is the prospect of the rise of a new capitalist system. Russia boasts that in between 1928 and 1937, it raised its industrial production by 625%. This is indeed a commendable achievement. Russian communism also claims that during the same period, the worth of Russian productive capital rose from 10 billion rubles to 75 billion rubles, meaning 7.5 times. The monetary value of ruble is very low at present. It also claims that in 1937, 1/3 of its national income was invested to expand its factories. This too is quite impressive, but the question is how long can Russia maintain this pace of expansion in an economy closed to foreign trade? The present situation is that the Russian economy is quite self-sufficient, with only a low level of imports and exports. Its imports are meant basically to satisfy the requirements of its industry. This situation resembles that of an Indian farmer, who raises a little sugarcane, some lentils, a little rice, wheat, and some oil seeds in his piece of land, and manages to subsist on these things. But obviously this situation cannot continue as economic and cultural progress takes place. At some point, exposure to the outside world must be faced. If it had been possible to maintain economic self-sufficiency forever, the conflicts seen all over the world, which led to world wars, would have never occurred. But the fact is that this state of self-sufficiency cannot continue indefinitely.